Muliebrity is the art and state of being a woman, and I think that should be celebrated. My name is Michelle Lyons. Welcome to the Celebrate Muliebrity podcast. Just a reminder, this podcast is for information only and not a substitute for consulting a healthcare professional. Hope you enjoy the show. One. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Celebrate Muliebrity. So if you're watching this on YouTube, hello. And if you're listening to this on the podcast, you're also welcome. I am so excited to have one of my favorite people. She is not only a learned colleague and a really good friend that I talk to on a fairly regular basis through the magic powers of Facebook. I'm really excited to have Dame Sue Croft here with us today, recent recipient of the OAM for her services to women's health in general, but pelvic health specifically. So, Sue, you've been a physio for many years and, you know, really, I think a huge contribution to awareness of what we can do to help women live well, particularly with pelvic health issues. One of the most recommended books from me is this book here, Pelvic Floor Essentials by Sue. The third edition is what I have here with, you know, this chapter is on bladder and bowel advice, prolapse management, children's continence, pregnancy and childbirth, pain management. I think it's something that every pelvic health clinician should have. And I think every woman should have as well. So Sue, welcome. And, you know, tell us about yourself and your journey so far in pelvic health.
Thank you for having me, Michelle, and I feel very privileged to be here. And I only expect a curtsy and a top of the hat every so often from you. So yeah,
good to know.
It was a very, very lovely surprise. But I think as I felt weird and, you know, the old imposter syndrome came to front when I got the email, but I've had such magnificent feedback from friends, colleagues, patients, everybody, that I feel a little bit more worthy of it, to be honest, just because I just feel like it's a great platform for pelvic health to just get recognized. And there are thousands and thousands of pelvic health physiotherapists who are equally worthy. But, you know, hey, I'm going to take it and run and hopefully get the opportunity to just sprout a bit more knowledge about and word about pelvic health physiotherapy and how incredible it is. And yeah. And I really think that I put it down to the fact that I do really love treating women, men and children, less men now. Yes, I've got some very talented physios who have taken that on. So I really see a lot of women and, you know, I love that I'm following through their life stages with them. You know, I always thank and thank my children for their what they gave me at each birth and a complete understanding of what pelvic floor dysfunction means. And so I think me having the lived experience does give me a lot of empathy and way too much insight into what my patients go through. But I'm going to do something immediately to rectify the situation that you only have the third edition, because in 2022 I released the fourth edition, which was very much updated, and so I will post that to you immediately, and so you can have a read of the fourth edition.
Fabulous.
It's there's a lot of stuff, and every time I do a book I always really want to get rid of the old versions, because as the evidence just piles up, you just think, oh gosh, that book's now 4 years old, and there's so much new to say, and it does affect our clinical practice. So I'm really happy and grateful the people I go and get my continuing professional development from, apart from the articles I read from IOGA and ICS, just really, you know, the beautiful Taryn Hallam, who really just reads it all, sifts through it, summarizes it, and gets it to us so we can just put it into practice in clinics so readily and easily.
Well, I think, you know, it was Dr. Maya Angelou who said, when you know better, you do better. So, you know, I think it's a great service that you go back and, you know, I know you're constantly attending conferences and reading and, you know, again, bringing us along with you on the journey. So today, Sue, I would love to talk to you about bladders, particularly how bladders behave, but often misbehave or get the blame for misbehaving at menopause. And that relationship between hormonal changes at menopause and the presentation that you're seeing in terms of bladder issues with women coming in to see you. And I suppose what you feel our journey towards best practice has become, whether we're talking about bladder leakage or some prolapse, or of course, pretty commonly, an overlap between the two. What sort of situations are you seeing with menopausal bladders?
So look, I think before we get onto that, I just want to quickly say that, you know, you can't actually beat sort of going through the basics with every patient. And, you know, you and I and others talk about critical thinking all the time. And so that, you know, when you're seeing a patient present with a problem, and what we do now, you know, is that we have basically the outline of the Australian Pelvic Floor questionnaire, which is now all online. So all our patients get that when they get their appointment. And what they do is they fill that in. And so that gives us a heads up as to what are their presenting problems in terms of what their symptoms that come under urinary incontinence, prolapse, sexual dysfunction. And also we have some psychosocial questions in there. And so we ask them, what are three goals or any number of goals that they want to put in there? What do they want to see out of the appointment? And one of the things I really want to emphasize to everybody is that you might think you've gone through a really amazing sort of treatment with a patient, but when you get to the end, if you don't ask them, well, you know, have I really done what you want in your goals? Do you think you've achieved what we wanted? Then it might look good to you, but it doesn't maybe fit what the patient really wants. And sometimes I think we're all capable, with the amount of knowledge we have, to go off and just, you know, sprout it all out, but they don't really understand and they haven't really found how it's applicable to their situation.
I think we get excited sometimes because, you know, we think we've figured out how best to help them. And maybe, you know, I think two things that kind of pop into my head when I hear you saying that is, one, absolutely, to make sure that we are listening as much as we're talking, and hopefully listening more than we're talking. But second of all, I really like the Kieran O'Sullivan test. And I don't know if you're familiar with this, but Kieran O'Sullivan is a researcher in back pain, done a lot of work with Peter O'Toole and with Mary O'Keefe. And the Kieran O'Sullivan test is, once you've explained everything to the patient, is you ask them to tell you what they're going to tell their partner or family members when they get home from treatment about what you explained to them. And just to make sure, because, you know, I'm sure that, you know, as with my experience, you've thought you've explained something particularly brilliantly to somebody, and then once they repeat it back to you, or they come back the next day, and you're like, oh, no, that's not what I said at all. So I think, again, you know, this education component, because we sometimes can live in a little bit of a bubble, thinking that this is all everybody talks about all day, every day, because it's what we talk about all day, every day. And so to really make sure that we're explaining to people what they need and what they want to know, and then we're following their lead in terms of goal setting. So I think that's a really important point. Thank you for bringing it up.
Yes. I think the other thing is that I mean, in your original email to me, you said, well, what do you think has changed compared to when I first started it? And seriously, when you start it 35 years ago, there's a lot of things that have changed. And I was just laughing because to myself, which I do quite a lot, is that, you know, when I started, we've had about five different research trends about whether you have an epidural when you're having a baby or not. And they've all been, you know, they've all it's completely swung around, and it does that every 10 years. So I think when I'm talking about why do I go to lots of PD still at this age, is because firstly, I think in the beginning, you don't know what you don't know. And so that when you go and do some really good courses and you think you've learned everything, if you don't actually keep going and diving deeper and deeper and understanding more about the little intricacies of how you apply that, then you don't necessarily, you know, you don't move on. You don't actually move on and start saying, well, there's actually more to this. This situation is much more complicated than we thought. So the other thing is that I just spend a whole lot of time talking to patients about their lives, you know, especially about, you know, what stress and anxiety that they have in their life. Because what has changed is I do everything from a biopsychosocial model now, whether they're coming in with pelvic pain, which sort of makes a lot of sense to a lot of people. But even if they've got urinary incontinence or prolapse, or they've got fecal incontinence, like there's such a psychosocial element to losing control of the basic things that we're expected to do from 3 years of age. So if you're not fecally continent or urinary incontinent, or you actually get a prolapse and you've read a lot about it, and you look at the mirror, but you have no idea what you're looking at, and you freak out, and the anxiety then takes over. And one of the things that I think is terribly important in understanding about a postmenopausal bladder and a woman, because she's not a, you know, she is a woman and she's a whole woman, and bladder sits there. And I don't know, a long time ago, I sat in an audience with James Malone, and gosh, it's terrible, I've forgotten the full name, but he was a brilliant
James Malone Lee.
Imagine, of course it was James Malone, and he had the bladder on a video isolated in a little, you know, dish of fluid, and it was pulsating away with its own little sort of nervous system there making it do that. And I mean, that's what we feel like our bladders are doing sometimes. They just have this mind of their own, and they're pulsating away without any control from this higher level. And so what I've come to realize over the last 5 years is that, you know, anxiety is a massive effect. And of course, if you look at a postmenopausal woman or a woman going through the perimenopause, so many of them go with anxiety symptoms to their doctor and they put on antidepressants, when in fact their hormones should be checked and looked at, because it ties in so much that anxiety and going through the menopause is just a thing. And so I think that I really just talk to everybody, and they think I'm just being really pleasant. But, you know, if they come in, I say, how are you? And they say, oh, this happened with a daughter-in-law, or that happened with my son, or that happened with my husband. You know, I'll go right down that rabbit hole, because often that's why their bladder has gone right off, is because it's the constant background of stress and anxiety, which has heightened their cortisol adrenaline levels. And, you know, it's the thing that's always causing problems with, you know, their weak point. And if their weak point, you know, 20 years ago was their bladder, and they've come back and they've got everything's really worse. And it's not just because of the lack of estrogen that comes with the menopause, but it's also the other things that do happen. And so the complicated lives that they have, and the multifaceted life when they've got a whole lot of different people introduced into the family. So I think it's just that thing of looking at the whole woman and understanding those little stories that she comes talking with are really probably the key to unlocking what the problem is and why it's exacerbated. So I spend a lot of time doing that. And all the time, the other thing that I do, and I don't think we need to go in order, but I think this is something that I really do with everybody straight away, very early, is they come in and that happened, and then this happened, and then I say, sit back in your chair. I've got a nice, comfy bit of supported chair. Sit back in your chair. I want your legs apart. I want your tummy off. And we're going to learn a bit about belly breathing. And so because over the last 5 years where I've dealt with different lots of anxiety, and you know all about them, Michelle, but, you know, I have relied on the fact that for 30 years before that, I've been teaching a lot about belly breathing and how to manage anxiety from, you know, an outsider's point of view. And now I've become an insider to it. And, you know, it's really brilliant if you train all the time to manage your anxiety well. You know, every 8 times a day for 1 minute, I teach my patients to stop, let your stomach go, let your pelvic floor go, drop your shoulders, do a quick body scan, and do some belly breathing for literally 1 minute. Then you're in training and you're really good. And so when the anxiety hits out of left field, then you're going to be really excellent because you will go straight into train. You've trained and now you're in the mode of actually dealing with it. And I say to my patients, sorry,
no,
one
please,
thing.
go.
To my patients, sorry, but I consider anxiety like the same as having a viral illness. So if you remember when you've got a flu, you get you feel a bit nauseous, you get the shakes, you get a bit of brain fog, you can't think clearly, you might ache all over, you might be quite distracted and you can't focus. And that's really what anxiety is like. And when people start treating anxiety for what it is, not just, oh, for God's sake, what's wrong with you, that it is like a viral illness and it needs a really careful approach, then that's when people start to get a massive improvement and they understand what to do if they are standing outside the cubicle with a sign on it that says, you know, the six toilets beside this one are all out of action and this is the only one we have. I'm just putting in brackets Brighton, the train trip to Brighton, you remember that? And, you know, you won't freak out. You'll let your stomach go. You'll do your belly breathing and you will curl your toes into the bargain as a neuromodulation strategy to help turn off that urge. You'll remember the bladder these urges do come in waves, so they do definitely subside if you're good with doing your urge control strategies. And so managing your anxiety, distracting your brain, using your urge control strategies through like toe curling, glute squeezing, neuromodulation strategies, you then can get control of that situation and get into that toilet cubicle one day, eventually when it frees, to do your wee. So I think that, so what is different particularly is the fact that I just spend a whole lot of time on managing whatever usually there is something is really set things in train and made things a whole lot worse.
Brilliant.
Now I'll let you speak.
No, that was brilliant, Sue. And I think, you know, I think we're just going to have to title this episode, you know, talking about the stress and stress incontinence, because, you know, the pelvic floor muscles are so responsive as well to what's happening with us psychologically, whether that's threat or fear or anxiety. But I think, you know, that's really, you know, what you've just encapsulated is just, I think, the epitome of both a top-down and a bottom-up approach, because you're looking at the whole person's experience of what's happening and how the stories that we tell ourselves can just ramp up our level of stress and tension. And of course, like if the pelvic floor is already up here, then when we do have to cough or sneeze, there's nowhere for it to go. It can't give us anything else. So I think just bringing everything back down and using something as deliciously simple as the breath is such a great way. And I know you're also a huge fan of man spreading. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about man spreading, because I think it's brilliant.
Look, we are conditioned from a very young age to actually cross your legs because men particularly always try
because
to look
we're ladies.
We're ladies. And it goes with our other little thing that physios have been terrible at propagating, this theory that we always must sit with excellent posture, otherwise our SIJ will go out. So, you know, I want the colour to drain from a patient's face, it's when I say, you know, you can have a slump, you can relax, you can let yourself just go, it's okay. And yes, you can let your legs go. And I think when we've got our inner thighs and our adductor muscles really switched on with our legs crossed and our belly is on, because we're a woman, we must also have a very flat stomach, then, of course, our pelvic floor is in this state of really being switched on. And the other thing I want to just say about having your pelvic floor on all the time with anxiety, you know, and I call the pelvic floor the first responders to our patients. So they're the ones when you hear about the tragic news on the whatever and someone you know has just gone there, that's when your pelvic floor is, you know, up here. And so the other thing is that these muscles fatigue so that when you actually need them, they won't come on. So if you've got someone who's suffering fecal incontinence, and we all know it's not as horrific as the event of having fecal incontinence may be, I think much worse than leaking urine. You know, when you have fecal incontinence, it's the actual unknown of when it's going to happen again that is the real anxiety-producing thing. So you have incidents, of course, but it's not knowing whether you can eat this. And I have patients who don't eat at work because they just are not going to eat because they get a very strong gastrocolic reflex, and then they're not going to, they don't know when that's going to hit. And so they're always in this constant anxiety, worrying about the potential for a fecal incontinence episode. So I think it's that thing of saying to patients, uncross your legs, sit like a man, relax, let your tummy go. So you give everything a nice rest. And then, you know, yes, your posture, you can sit up tall by all means, but you can also vary it. So, you know, the other one of my favorite sayings, which is definitely stolen from somewhere else, I just can never remember where, is, you know, your best posture is your next posture. So that, you know, don't believe everything you see on all the short little Instagram things. You know, you can slump, and it's great to do that, particularly if you've got pelvic floor dysfunction, because so much of it is tied up with the pelvic floor being over gripped and overly switched on.
And
I think if we come back to...
Go ahead. I was just going to put in as well,
how do I approach a patient? And I want to just go through urinary incontinence, because there are some really important things for me. Like,
go for it.
I still see lots of times where patients come to me, and they might have been to see urogynies, gynies, urologists, maybe another physio or two, and nobody's ever done a basic old bladder diary. And, you know, I can't emphasize how important a basic old bladder diary is. And so what's changed for us is that a long time ago, I started giving every patient a white specimen. So the value of that is not just the fact they get an accurate thing where they can put it in the toilet and relax everything, so they're not holding a jug in a wacky position, but they can also look at the clarity of the urine and look at what the color is like. And, you know, that a lot gets hidden if it just drops down into the toilet, you know, and you don't realize. They don't realize either how concentrated the urine is, or potentially what blood is in their urine, or how cloudy it is, that they're, you know, probably trundling along with a low-grade urinary tract infection that is what's exacerbating it. So, and I think just while I slip that in, like, you can't underestimate how important it is to send someone along for microurine just to make sure that their sudden change in incontinence is not necessarily the fact they're perimenopausal, but they've actually got an infection that's not really giving them the razor blade pain or the distinct blood in the urine. It's actually just presenting as worsening frequency and urgency and urge incontinence. So I think it's they're basic things, bladder diary, send people for a microurine. And the other thing that I think has hugely changed, I mean, I've had an ultrasound for a long time, but, you know, for the first, until I had my own rooms, which was 2002, I used to go to visiting rooms. And so I'd have my baskets of things, and the ultrasound was not capable of fitting into a basket to take to a doctor's surgery or whatever room I was renting. And so being able to buy my own ultrasound machine and do a pre-post scan on every single woman, because, or man or child, because so many times we can get caught out if we treat their urge incontinence frequency, urgency, purportedly, with urge control strategies, send them to the doctor for some, you know, anticholinergics or antimuscarinics before we knew that we weren't going to do that anymore and we're going to use mirabegron or Betmega. Then you're treating them as though they've got a problem with their detrusor muscle instead of them having an emptying problem. And so when you do an ultrasound and see that they never empty and they've got 100 mils or 150 mil residual, and in fact, that's what's giving them the frequency. So I do that with every single person, all the girls, and it's the bane of my secretary's existence that they have to be at attention all the time, watching for those patients slipping down the corridor to go to the toilet before their appointment, because we want to do that scan so we can see, well, are we treating true urge incontinence and urgency or frequency, or are we treating a problem with bladder retention?
I think that's so important that we are actually treating what we think we're treating, because, you know, as you said, we've moved beyond giving three sets of 10, you know, squeeze and relax. Yeah. And I think, though, you know, particularly at menopause, you know, we have to also acknowledge that changing levels of estrogen are going to affect the pH of the, you know, around the vulva and the urethra. And that can be a driver as well for these recurrent UTIs. And to make sure, because again, I think sometimes the things that we think are obvious are not always obvious. And to be able to say to them, look, I think you need to have a chat with your GP or your OBGYN or whoever about maybe some topical estrogen in around there, because I think topical estrogen plus specifically directed pelvic rehab, it's just this phenomenal combination. You know, I think each makes the other better. We know that Mercier study looking at pelvic physio for say 12 weeks can really do wonderful things in restoring pudendal blood flow. But I think getting that topical estrogen in there as well, really to give the urethra a bit of support. You know, it's not that long ago that we even discovered that the bladder, that urine isn't sterile, that the bladder has a microbiome. And I think that really kind of echoes what you were saying about the importance of staying up to date and moving with the times, so that we are giving the best possible advice to the people that we serve. In your opinion and in your experience, are your medical colleagues receptive to hearing suggestions for you about things that are maybe not traditional physio scope in terms of recommending different medications, whether that's topical estrogen or having the Betmega conversation? What's the best way that you found
Absolutely,
works?
Absolutely, Look, yeah. I think when you've got an OAM after your name, it definitely makes a lot of, no, I'm joking. So what really, I don't have any trouble with, and none of our girls do. Like, I think that GPs know now because we are obliged to write a letter. We get a lot of what we call TCAs or enhanced primary care plans where they get a little smidgen from Medicare to come for 5 visits, and we don't bulk bill because we put a lot of time and effort and there's a lot of cost associated with running a practice. So they come, they pay the balance. It's nothing is free. It comes, we have to write letters back. So they've been getting letters back from us for a long time about what we do. And I don't think they now stand. And I mean, I think it's really important for younger physios there to be careful how you write things. Like, I think there's a way to say to some doctor, like, they need local estrogen without saying they need local estrogen. Like, yes. I think that you can word it such that it is not threatening and it doesn't appear to be out of your scope, but you're just saying that I feel like she would benefit from that, and that, you know, there's just a way to word things. And I think when you're looking at any letter you're sending off to prospective referrers, just look at it and say, well, how would you like it if you received that letter? If it sounds indignant and demanding, then I don't think you're going to get there. And I often will write a letter and I'll go back and read it and I change, just, you know, not shoulds to would it be possible, you know, like you just sort of change the direction and the way you speak about it. And so that when they're reading it, they're going to be, but no, to be honest, like, I think they're always pretty grateful when, you know, I've had to sort of alert a few of them and with patients, but certainly the thing that we were talking about before was the change or the awareness of the impact of the anticholinergics and antimuscarinics. Now, interestingly, that research has been around since 2005. It's first started to be talked about, and it's really taken a long time. And, you know, I've heard even some gynies and urogynies who sort of say, oh, that's nothing. But look, I've got the lived experience, as you know, Michelle, of very close family members who have extremely severe Alzheimer's dementia. And I wouldn't do anything at all that had the slightest hint that, and, you know, with the anticholinergics, they've got, 40 to 50% of risk associated with 1 to 3 years on an anticholinergic like Vesicare, which once you find something that helps your leakage, these patients don't want to give it up because, you know, it helps their urgency and their leakage. So it takes a lot of convincing to say, well, you know, there are now things we know about. And I think saying in 2021, you know, I now can say that and say, this is what has been found, but there is this other drug which doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, which has an effect on relaxing the bladder muscle, allowing it to store more. And yes, it's ridiculously expensive, but, you know, there are ways we can get around that. And so, you know, I think it's really important to understand that the GPs are flooded there with it. The time they can spend with their patients, it's really short. And they're very grateful if, and they know we spend a lot of time with the patient. So Avestin and I mean, there are two in Australia, there are Avestin ovules and Avestin cream, and there's Vagifem pessaries. And so I tend to always go to Avestin cream.
Same.
It doesn't have the blue plastic thing that you throw away all the time for the environment. It is a little bit more effective. So Vagifem low lost a lot of its oomph when they reduced it about five, 6 or 7 years ago from Vagifem 25 to Vagifem 10. So, you know, I definitely find that Avestin is better. And, you know, if you explain why it is that it decreases the risk of urinary tract infections, improves the seal because of the plumping up of the urethra, and it has an effect on the overactive bladder, they're three compelling reasons. And, of course, oftentimes the patients might have a bit of prolapse as well, and we look to see where they're putting in a little pessary, either for the support of the prolapse or as a continence pessary. So it might be a continence dish, it might be a contiform, it might be a ring with knob, it might be a marlin, and it might even be the Australian one, which is a CPOP pessary, which has a nice little side effect that it actually helps really nicely with a little bit of urinary leakage. It's not a urinary incontinence pessary, but it has this byproduct, which is a nice little discovery. And so, you know, we really need, we can't put a pessary in a postmenopausal woman really confidently without having some local estrogen. So I think because we are very good with sending letters and communicating, like I communicate all the time with doctors. I ring them and say, this is Mrs. So-and-so is presented with this. This is what I'm worried about. Can we get a microurine? And she'll book in for an appointment to read the results so that you if you communicate, they get to know you, and then they respect you.
And
if
they
you
trust you.
Yeah. And they're not, they know you're not trying to do their job. You just know that what you're seeing, because you've seen a lot of it, that this might be something, but I'm really indicating I'm ready to listen to their alternate view. I'm not being so, you know, full of myself that I think that there can't be an alternate view.
I think for me, one of the things that kind of really made a difference with my communication with doctors around topics like this is just very simply asking the question, you know, what do you think? Do you think topical estrogen would be a good fit for her? You know?
Yes.
And I think just having that kind of collegiate attitude rather than a power struggle, sometimes it can come across as is really, really important. And I think for a lot of physios, It's about dealing with what we started talking about at the start of this chat. It's that imposter syndrome. And I think sometimes maybe we overcompensate a little bit for that. And it's just to realize this is our, you know, this is our zone of genius. I mean, I have such respect for GPs because they have to know a little bit about everything. Whereas, we live in the pelvis. And yes, of course, the pelvis is attached to a person and we have a psychosocial as well as a bio approach. But generally, I think, you know, I have found medical colleagues to be very receptive. And I think that's where maybe even going to conferences like IUGA and ICS to just realize that we're all playing for the same team, you know, and it doesn't have to be a struggle. And I think as professions are evolving as well, I think there's definitely more of an emphasis on interdisciplinary communication, which can really only benefit the person that we're working for.
Yeah. Look, I think the evidence is also stacking up so strongly that it's a very resistant medical person who doesn't see the value. And in Australia, Michelle, I'm sure you've heard about the Australian, I have to always look at their name, it's the Australian Health Commission on Health and Safety, Australian Commission, I can't find a bit of paper because I always have to write it down, but Australian Commission on Health and Safety. So they have one for incontinence, they have one for mesh, they have one for prolapse. And they have one which the fantastic and very talented, clever Natalie McConaughey was very involved with in terms of third and fourth degree tears. So the management of that and to prevention of that. So these are documents which really have taken it out of the hands of any professional saying, I know everything and this is what you're going to do. Because when you look at that on each of those things, the first thing that, you know, with incontinence and prolapse, it says, what's the first thing you can do? Well, you can do nothing. So, you know, I hate it, of course, because I think that's so ridiculous because we've got so much to give. Why would we do nothing? But that's beside the point. That's saying to the patient, you know, they don't have to do anything. The second thing it says that conservative management, and again, I hate that word, but you know, because conservatives have some sort of negative connotations for me, but what it is that this whole holistic approach to looking at the whole patient, looking at their lifestyle, looking at these well-known strategies that we have that encompass under our public health physio banner, education being the absolute cornerstone of it. And so being effective with your education is so important. All of that is number two. And then the surgical options via the prolapse or incontinence are number three. And so I think that it goes out on our email along with our pelvic intake form, is each of those things so that they can actually look at it and say, oh, okay, rightio, well, there's a document that looks pretty important coming from the Australian government saying this is what you do. Maybe nothing, see the physio and learn the conservative stuff and in conjunction with working with that team. We have got to be a team. And even though we can't always work in a multidisciplinary team like you can in a hospital or a unit, you know, I think it's that thing of understanding and embracing the fact that you must communicate with your GP, with your surgeon. And we are blessed here in Queensland and in Brisbane, because really all of the people that we work with, you know, the gynies, the urogynies, are mostly, you know, understanding that we do play a role.
Yeah.
Urologist, but anyway, you know, definitely gynies and GPs understand that we do make the time to spend with patients that is required when you're educating them about a bladder, which, remember, for a long time their mum taught them how to manage their bladder, and if mum had an incontinence problem and a frequency problem, then they're going to teach their little girl or boy to develop one as well, because when mum goes to the toilet, Johnny comes to the toilet. When mum goes to the toilet before she leaves the house, she drags all the kids in with her as well. So, you know, they're always trained with these beliefs that you must always use a toilet when you see it. And that's what starts the journey towards this bladder, which doesn't remember what its job is, to store urine passively and to, when it's full, to give you a nice, comfortable urge and time to get to the toilet. So, you know, just that simple education about good bladder habits is so important.
Brilliant. I think, Sue, that's just, you know, it's really encapsulated, I think, what it is to have the psychosocial on an equal footing with the bio, that we have moved beyond just prescribing pelvic floor exercises.
Yes.
And it's to, I think, you know, one of the reasons that you were nominated for your OAM is because of the service that you do, is to educate not only us fellow clinicians, but women at large. Because I think, again, maybe a lot of the things that we think are common sense and are in the domain of everybody knowing what's normal, it's not always so. And I think just normalizing the conversation around pelvic health is so important as well. Can I just finish up by asking you, if you could tell your younger baby physio self one thing, you know, before starting out in pelvic health, you know, what would you, with the benefit of your wisdom and your sagacity now, what would you tell baby pelvic physios starting out in the world to remember as, you know, a really key point for moving forward?
Well, I think it is about this thing that it's not a bladder and a pelvic floor isolated, like in that bladder that was sitting in that bowl of fluid that, you know, I saw at that conference. You know, you've got to think about the whole person, and that, you know, in medicine, you have to keep believing that what you're teaching may change tomorrow. And so, and what we haven't talked about, and I really just want to throw in there, is like the fact that now using a TENS unit to do transtibial nerve stimulation to actually help with an overactive bladder. So when you look at the research, you've got, you know, TENS even standing alone does as well as Vesicare. And so why would you take a medication that might, you know, make you gaga later on when you can just use TENS and watch Netflix at night for 45 minutes? You don't even have to do any pelvic floor exercise. You just passively sit there, you know, watching it, binge watching Netflix. So, you know, I think that is the thing, that you have to keep looking and reading and changing and understanding about the fact that there is so much out there that we can learn. And you know, when we talked before, like about the GPs, I have to say that is the other thing that I do feel swamped and overwhelmed at times with how much it is blown up. Like, you know, if I had to know this much when I first started out in 1988, when I started, if I had to know that much, now I have to know this much, like it's off the screen, because we are realizing how invaluable exploring and understanding, like I can still remember, and I'm embarrassed to say it, but like it was in 2008, I was still giving pelvic floor exercises to someone who had persistent pain because I didn't really understand. I couldn't let go of the fact that, you know, that pelvic floor exercises weren't still in there somewhere, you know, and they may be in the sense that, you know, you learn how to turn it on so you can relax it. But I mean, I feel mortified about that. You know, whoever that last patient was that I sort of emphasized with it. And I think, oh gosh, you know, it's so crazy how that was. And so I think that thing of when I started down the pathway of learning about Lorimer Moseley and David Butler's work, and that's not all. I mean, it's just that thing of understanding your patients. Then when you understand about the relationship of the brain and how it is so, you just cannot ignore it. Then you start to look and go down a whole lot of other rabbit holes and expand your knowledge so much. So I think it's that thing of just keep learning, keep reading, keep looking. Not, don't think you know it all. And I think the other thing I just want to say is, like, I think we've got so much access to social media and so much access to ways of presenting things, but we want to still maintain our credibility. And I think it's really important that we can still teach effectively without sort of demeaning how we present the information. Like, I just want to say, let's just keep it nice and professional. And so we do keep the respect that I think pelvic health physiotherapy has, and still impart the information, but just keep it sort of remembering we want to be considered in a professional way, and that would be helpful. So yeah, that's probably an important thing for me.
I think that's a really important thing to remember. And just to kind of circle back to what you were saying about TENS and tibial nerves, we will have a full episode about the glory of TENS machines with our favorite electro guru, Ms. Fiona Rogers. So we'll be taking a deep dive into that on a future chat. I think that's it. If we want to be taken seriously as professionals, you know, we have to be professional. It's not rocket science, you know? You know, again, circling back to where we started talking about, don't forget the importance of breathing when it comes to pelvic health. It doesn't have to be super complicated. Just take a deep breath and relax and connect with the person in front of you, because it's scary when you don't have control of your bladder or your bowel. And we can, I think, sometimes become immune to that because it's what we talk about. But, you know, for that person, it's maybe their first time talking about it. And to recognize that fear, and particularly with bowel leakage, it's terrifying. Yeah. It's absolutely terrifying.
But the other thing, Michelle, just briefly, like, you know, it's recognizing there's that perimenopause, the menopause, postmenopause, but there's then the new little charmer of aging. And, you know, there are definite things that change with aging. You know, get a loss of elastin, loss of 2% from 15 to 80 in the actual total number of striated muscle fibers in urethral wall. So you get decreased urethral closing pressure, stiffer smooth muscle, which affects the urethra and your bladder. You've got decreased flow rate in urodynamics, increase in uninhibited contractions, decreased bladder capacity. So you know, you've got the things that change that we might be able to affect in terms of adding some estrogen, acknowledging the role, giving them the education, but we have to keep moving with the patient. And just because we fixed it up at 45 to 55 doesn't mean that at 60 they're going to suddenly not present with a whole new world of, you know, things going off. So it's that thing of also encouraging your patients to follow you through, like to actually go on a yearly basis so they can catch up with what you've learned at the last conference. So you can actually say, well, how are you going with your continuity of doing the things we talked about? And then this is what's the dilemma. Now you've entered this, post-60 age where there are these physiological changes, and what can we do about it? And, understanding that there are definitely things we can do, because we all become a bit more inactive potentially. Yes. Yeah. And so that we can embrace exercise. And so that's the other thing really that is massively different. Like every single patient, I'm asking them, what exercise are you doing? And that's a part of their urinary incontinence treatment. What exercise are you doing, and why? What can we do? What are the roadblocks to you doing exercise? What can we do to try and introduce that in?
Brilliant. So where can people find your blogs, you, and where can people buy your books?
Okay, so Michelle, there's the fourth edition that's going to come in the mail to you, okay? There's this one, which is going to fourth edition. It's going to be updated sometime soon.
So okay? For people who are listening, that's Pelvic Floor Recovery and Pelvic Floor Essentials are the two main books.
For gynecological and colorectal repair surgery. So that's for the people who are having surgery. And the last one for any German-speaking people out there who might be listening to Michelle's blog, this is called Beckenboden Rehabilitation. So it is the surgical book translated into German. So you can go to pelvicfloorrecovery.com, which is our shop website that you can buy them. And also I do write a blog, and the blog is something I'm really, really, I'm quite proud of it because I'm still doing it. Started in 2011. It's now 12 years old, and I still rather give up doing anything, any job, and write a blog, which is always good. And so there's lots and lots of stuff. And so I think what I liked about Michelle asking me to talk about urinary incontinence is it's right back at the beginning, and now I talk about a lot of things and no one ever asked to talk about urinary incontinence. So it's really good to get back and just start right at the beginning. And so there's lots and lots of categories there on pelvic pain, urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, and a few trips to Italy that might be mentioned once or twice in there.
Fabulous.
Just blog and it comes up, and you can have a look at all the different categories,
and we can find you on social media.
Blogs on there. Okay.
We can find you on social media as well: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
Yes. Super. Absolutely. Yeah.
Look her up.
Yeah.
So absolutely fabulous. So many clinical pearls there that I think will really, I think will help move people's practice forwards and help us to help women live well, which I think is our mission overall. So yeah, really all that remains is for me to say thank you so much for being so generous with your time and your knowledge as always, and to encourage everybody to check out Sue's blogs, her books, her wisdom, and don't forget to curtsy if you meet her in the street. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you prefer to watch, all the videos of the interviews will be uploaded onto YouTube. If you'd like to learn more, there's a full suite of online courses on women's health, including courses on female pelvic pain rehab, female hormonal health, oncology rehab, and more. And don't forget to follow me on Instagram, Michelle_Lyons_MuleyEverty, for special offers and announcements. Until the next time, celebrate Muley Everty. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.